President Trump swore in a new chief of staff on Monday, John Kelly. The White House says Kelly is starting with a clean slate, with the ouster just hours later of White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci, only 10 days, 11, depending on how you count, into the job. This comes after the resignation Friday of Reince Priebus, the former chief of staff. We're navigating these developments with Charles Franklin, the director of the Marquette University Law School Poll and professor of law and public policy. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here. Good morning.
Well, let's start with the chief of staff. Kenosha native Reince Priebus resigned last week, marking the shortest tenure ever for any White House chief of staff. A lot of people figured Priebus was on his way out. Any surprise there on his departure?
He may also be the chief of staff with the rumors that he was leaving starting earliest, because I think we've heard these rumors since March or so. In that sense, he hung on longer than the rumor mill would have made you expect. But it is a short term. I think you do have to consider the nature of this White House, the nature of the president, and his penchant for a certain level, at least, of disorder and surprise, and also control. I think by any accounts, Priebus was never given the authority that chiefs of staff have had in the past in order to control the White House. That includes things that might seem trivial, but in past administrations, the chief of staff has determined who gets in to see the president and when do they get in. In this White House, an unusual number of people have supposed Oval Office privileges,
open door
privileges, the ability to walk in when they want to. And that just necessarily reduces a chief of staff's authority. I think it's also fair to say that Priebus had served in party positions as chair of the Republican Party here in Wisconsin, chair of the National Republican Committee, but he had not worked in a formal government role or the federal government role. So he did come in with less experience of the bureaucracy than is typical for chiefs of staff.
He made some rounds of interviews after he stepped down Friday night. He said that President Trump wanted to go in a different direction and that he was still on board the Trump train. Here he is on Fox News Friday evening.
I'm going to be on Team Trump all the time. I'll always be out there trying to help the president advance his goals, support him.
So doesn't seem like loyalty is in question there. And it was loyalty, perhaps, is the reason he was told to go.
I think that Priebus's career has been one of serving the institution that he's part of. As chair of the Republican National Committee, he pursued initiatives that would help the party. After initially being critical of Trump, as it became clear that Trump was going to win the nomination of the party, Priebus pivoted and brought the party's resources in line to support the president's run, or then candidate Trump's run, and stuck with him for the most part throughout the fall, occasionally being critical at certain times, like the Access Hollywood video. But in general, I think you see here an organization man committed to the organization that he's been connected with.
Company man.
And, as a purely strategic decision, going out as the loyalist may be more helpful for his future prospects than going out as a disgruntled fired worker.
So Trump's new chief of staff, retired General John Kelly, former head of Homeland Security, he was sworn in yesterday. Within a few hours, we learned that Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci was fired at Kelly's request. What do we know, first of all, Scaramucci aside, what do we know about Kelly and Trump's choice in the job?
Right. John Kelly gets very high marks from most Washington observers as a general, a Marine Corps general for, I believe, over 40 years of active duty service. You see people on both the left and the right being positive about him in that. In his Senate confirmation hearings for Department of Homeland Security chief, he got a fair bit of Democratic support. So in that sense, as a matter of the character of the person, you see a lot of support. Now, at Homeland Security, he's been responsible for implementing many of the immigration policies of the Trump administration, which are highly controversial, to say the least. But he has done those in ways that the president has been happy with. And I think it'd be fair to say that Kelly has avoided a very much direct criticism of him, as opposed to some fairly widespread criticism of the policies. I think if this sends any signal, it is the simple signal that Kelly is not Reince Priebus, that he has been given the authority of the president to make a major move like this immediately. Now, that's what's happened on the first day in the office, and I think it's fair to say we don't know what's going to happen on the second day.
Or the third.
I just checked my Twitter stream, and so far the president hasn't tweeted this morning. But I think as we go through the week, do we see more sense of order at the White House? Do they manage to stay on message during the week?
And that will also be important. Will Kelly have the control of the staff?
I think that's exactly the question. Scaramucci famously, in 11 days, bragged that he had direct report to the president. He did not have to go through the chief of staff.
Reince Priebus.
The Reince Priebus. The shot across the bow from Kelly yesterday is, you know, no, you do have to pay attention to me. Now, the problem is with the president's daughter and son-in-law and other close aides going far back in Trump's life, how much can Kelly do that? So I think in a way you're seeing the first day all the positivity poured out on Kelly, that he has all these organizational abilities. He was able to deal with the Scaramucci situation on the first day. I think let's look back in 2 weeks or 4 weeks and see whether the chaos at the White House seems to have been reduced.
Give it some time.
Or not.
Yeah. Talking right now with Charles Franklin, the director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy, discussing politics this hour, 800-642-1234, looking at shakeups in the White House. Also going to take a look later this hour at the Foxconn incentive package and the politics happening right here on the home front in Wisconsin. Back to Scaramucci here. Trump brought him in less than 2 weeks ago, as we said, as part of this effort to stop these damaging leaks within the White House, which is, you know, wound up forcing Press Secretary Sean Spicer to resign. What kind of mark did Scaramucci leave on the Trump presidency?
Aside from perhaps stimulating the turnover that led to Spicer leaving, you know, we've been talking about him leaving since really his first briefing, as well as Priebus. With Scaramucci, you've now got three major players in the White House that have turned over in 12 days. You have a new leader in the chief of staff who's, at the very least, sending strong signals that he'll control the staff side of things, whether or not he can control the president.
Is another matter.
That's another matter, and that's true of all presidents. The chief is the staff of the president there. But I think what you're seeing is that shift of some lingering problems. Now, when the White House or the president hired Scaramucci, it seemed he was channeling his inner Trump. He brought in someone who talked the way Trump does, who was a New York wheeler and dealer. And in a way, it seemed to send the signal that this will be a White House that is Trump squared. It'll be Trump on steroids, where the communication shop will reflect Trump's feelings. There were photos of Scaramucci's gestures looking like Trump's. You know, you can talk about that as being a sycophant, but you can also say it's how well they seem to reinforce each other. That only lasted 11 days. And so I think in that you're seeing a sharp pivot. Now, did it come because the president was unhappy with the way things had gone? Surely that was a big part of it. how much of it was because General Kelly saw that as an untenable situation, not the way the order could possibly be restored. But whatever the reasons, the clearing of the decks, if you will, and the opportunity to install a new set of high-level officials is there.
Yeah. We're combing through the recent developments in politics with Charles Franklin. He's director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy. What do you make of the recent shakeups in the Trump administration? How would you like to see the administration proceed with North Korea? Are you worried about North Korean missile tests? 800-642-1234. You can also post your thoughts on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Back in a moment after these news headlines. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. President Trump's approval rating dipped to a new low yesterday in the latest Rasmussen poll. Rasmussen found that just 39% of likely U.S. voters approved of the job Trump is doing, while 61% disapproved of the president. We're breaking down political developments this hour with Charles Franklin. He's director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policies. He's also co-founder of pollster.com and the founder of pollsandvotes.com. You can join in this discussion, 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about North Korea's nuclear ambitions? Where should Congress go from here? Should Republicans cut their losses and move on from repealing and replacing Obamacare? Join us, 800-642-1234, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's start, Charles, by talking about North Korea and nuclear ambitions here, where the president says we will be handling North Korea. What do we know about North Korea right now?
Well, what we know about North Korea is that they are deep in the testing phase of an intercontinental ballistic missile. They had gone through substantial development problems over the past 4 or 5 years. But over the last 12 to, let's call it, 18 months, they've had a series of successful test launches that follow trajectories and time in their trajectory, in their path, that are convincing to national security folks that it will be a missile capable of hitting most places in the continental U.S. within 6 months to 2 years. They have also gone through a series of successful nuclear weapons tests, though those are underground tests, and there's a difference between being able to detonate a nuclear explosion underground and having one that's compact enough and reliable enough to put on the tip of a missile and send it around the world and come through reentry. So I think that the risk that we face is one that is growing substantially in the last few years and is now close to the stage where deployment of a missile or a small number of nuclear missiles is in the foreseeable future. The question is, what do you do to handle the problem? And that is very, very difficult, and President Trump has been...
He used the word handle.
Yeah, he uses the word handle, but with no specificity.
Yeah.
He has pressured the Chinese at the beginning to intervene with North Korea, but judging from his Twitter stream, which is seemingly the place that he discusses these things, he has said over the last week that he's given up on China's help and is very unhappy with them. It's as if he expected the Chinese to be able to stop the nuclear program in Korea in 6 months. Well, that seems naive, to put it mildly. But there is a question of how much China or anyone else can influence North Korea and how much it's in North Korea's rational self-interest to develop this weapon, because it gets them a great deal more leverage in the world than if they don't have this weapon.
Well, John in Eau Claire is with us with a point on North Korea. John, go ahead.
I'd say North Korea is, to use a metaphor, they're like a guy with a big stick. He you don't send another person with a big stick to deal with them, because then there's only two options, either fight or run away. We need to redirect North Korea. Quit approaching them through Chinese. Quit, try and make some sort of a deal with them. Work with them to change their direction. They want to work on rockets? That's fine. Let's help get them to the moon. Redirect them instead of attack them.
Can they be redirected?
Well, it's a great question. There have been periods over the last 20 years where diplomacy with North Korea has produced some moderate success. They have gone through their own leadership change in the last few years and seem a bit more intractable than they were earlier. The Obama administration had a different set of policies, but that has turned out not to prevent this development of the nuclear weapon. And so what kind of diplomatic engagement do you have? What are realistic goals for how to deal with it? And the biggest issue is North Korea doesn't exist in isolation. Seoul, South Korea, is within artillery range of North Korea. And so there is no military option that would not be utterly disastrous for the civilian population of South Korea.
A massive city
with massive armaments, conventional weapons, artillery and short-range missiles aimed at the city, with estimates of tens to hundreds of thousands of weapons that could be directed at South Korea in the first hour of a conflict. So this is a difficult military option. There certainly does not seem to be any simple single stroke that would put an end to the Korean threat. Therefore, diplomacy becomes important. And to the extent the president first placed too much confidence in China's ability or willingness to change things, and now seems utterly dismissive of them, we seem to have veered between a plausible diplomatic approach to now the rejection of that when it has had very little time to have any effect.
A lot of cold to hot.
Well, so it seems.
Trump's approval rating in this recent poll, Rasmussen poll, as we mentioned before, has him at 39%, which is an all-time low. And it comes after what some observers were calling the worst week of his presidency, amid the staffing issues we talked about earlier, the defeat of health care reform in the Senate, the Boy Scouts speech, and then his announcement that the military would no longer accept transgender troops. As a pollster yourself, what is your reaction of this 39% approval rating?
I think it has been the worst week yet, though that's a superlative that keeps getting changed as weeks go by. But last week was truly striking for a number of things that went against the president's wishes or interests. Now, the Rasmussen poll has almost always polled higher for the president, better approval ratings than almost any other poll. On June 16th, they had his approval at 50%, and the president tweeted about that and pointed to Rasmussen as the best pollster out there. It has now fallen in that poll to 39% approval. That's the first Rasmussen poll to fall under 40%. They've never been that low. And it puts them in line with other polls. The Real Clear Politics average has 39% average approval. That's right where Rasmussen is right now. And Gallup is at 37%. So we've seen some convergence between the polls. But I think it's striking that while Rasmussen has worked its way down over the last few weeks, the Gallup poll, which also does daily tracking polls, mm-hmm. has fluctuated between 36% approval and 39% approval, seemingly unable to break out of that either on the low side or on the high side. So since early to mid-June, Gallup and the average of all polls has been remarkably flat, despite it being a period of troubles for the administration. This last week and its impact, we really won't know until late this week as we get new polling after all of the changes and events of last week and in the White House yesterday.
Should we be putting a lot of stress on these polls? Should we be looking for answers from these polls? Should we care about these polls?
Of course we should care about these polls. That one's easy to answer. I think there are two ways to think about it. The polls are an ongoing record of how the public's responding to events and to the actions of the president. In that sense, yes, we should. In a second sense, how the president is standing in the polls is one of the strongest predictors we have of how his party does in the midterm elections. Now, we're still a good ways away from those midterms, so this is only a vague indicator at this point. But the president's approval rating is below that of any other president at this just over 6-month point in his term, and so it is an important indicator. I think the flip side of that is opponents of the president take great glee when Rasmussen drops from 41 to 39, as if that were an important crossroads. It's not. That number may very well bounce up today or tomorrow by a point or two or three, just as the Gallup poll has fluctuated within a 4-point range. And so, and when we look at previous presidents, it has required a number of months to see genuinely lasting change in their overall approval. So the president right now is down about 4 to 6 points from where he was at the beginning of his term in 6 months. If he drops another 4 to 6 points, that means he will be down 8 to 12 points from an already low level at the end of his first year. That would signal real trouble to be in the low 30s at the end of 12 months in office. Where he is right now signals trouble, but we don't know if it's going to flatten out, if his supporters are going to stick with him no matter what, or if we will see some continued erosion.
Let's take another call now at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Laurel now in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Laurel. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering why nobody is talking about the possibility of all these things that have been going on lately, like all the staff changes, the transgender ban in the military. Why isn't anybody talking about the testimony of Bill Browder in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings?
So you want more discussion about the Russia investigation?
Yes, because the same day that Trump announced the ban on transgenders in the military, there was pretty explosive testimony in the Senate hearing about Russian involvement and Russian operatives in the U.S. or people cooperating with them.
Yeah, let's get Charles to weigh in. Charles.
Yeah, I think this is, so I actually think that's been talked about a fair bit, that you could look at the president's Twitter stream or other things that he says or speeches that he gives as things designed to draw attention to him and allow him to control what we're all talking about, what we all in the media are talking
control
about
the message
for the day.
Yeah.
And there is a substantial distraction from the ongoing Russia investigations in both the Senate and to a lesser extent these days the House, but certainly the Mueller special counsel investigation. I think the side point, though, is that those investigations are grinding slowly but steadily. And in the Senate in particular, we've seen we've not seen the partisan break that we saw in the House that really disabled their investigation to some extent. So the Senate investigation is moving along with new testimony, new evidence. The Mueller investigation seems to not be leaking at all. And so we don't really know where the Mueller investigation is. But I think this is a distinction between short-term distraction, as you would put it, and as I would largely agree, versus the long-term consequences of serious investigations conducted by serious people and amounting in the end to substantial evidence, and ultimately we'll see what their reports say.
Well, Laurel, thanks for keeping an eye on it, and thanks for calling in. We're talking with Charles Franklin right now. He's director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's a professor of law and public policy. He's also co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. You can weigh into this political discussion, 800-642-1234. We're going to now turn our attention to what Congress is doing. Senate Republicans were unable to get anything done in the way of repealing and replacing Obamacare besides passing a vote to open debate. Some members of Congress want to move on to another issue, but the president wants Republicans to keep trying. He's even threatened to cut Congress members' benefits that allow part of their Obamacare premium cost to be covered by taxpayers. Charles, how do you weigh trying to repeal a law you've been opposed to from the start versus cutting your losses and passing other items on the Trump agenda?
Right. I think that the devastating aspect of repeal and replace is that with 7 years of rhetoric and opportunity to plan for what that would look like, independent of the Trump administration, the House and Senate have proved themselves completely unable, unprepared to specify a serious, effective replacement for
But they had seven
Obamacare.
Years, Republicans had 7 years to get behind a replacement.
Indeed, and I think that is a devastating comment on the lack of policy seriousness of the party, that it did not arrive in office and in control with a consensual set of changes that they could do. I think you can certainly complain if you're a Republican that the White House has given virtually no leadership on this issue, and the president shows little understanding of what the technical issues are. But he does repeat and continue to push the criticism from Republican voters that we wanted you to do something and now you're failing to do it. The irony is you see a Republican president attacking the Republican Party. That is a very unusual situation. But I think no amount of White House rhetoric right now can create a plan in the Congress when the Congress has proven unable to develop that plan itself. And there are outside groups that study health care seriously from a conservative perspective that have put together proposals that could have been adopted by the Congress. And those are serious proposals. And yet the Congress wasn't able to coalesce on any of those proposals either. So I really do think we're in a situation where factions within the Republican Party make it hard to do this. The benefits that the public is receiving, despite problems with those benefits, are hard to take away. And a party that's been motivated by the rhetoric of repeal is now faced with the reality that they really don't know what to do and don't know how to do it. The president's not helping that matter. There are ways that he could behave, that the administration could behave, which will hurt Obamacare more, likely driving up insurance costs, likely driving down coverage rates without any change in the law.
Such as?
One is reimbursing insurance companies for expenses in order to hold down premiums and deductibles for people who are on the Obamacare coverage. The president does that, and the Obama administration does that, from month to month because the Congress has refused to appropriate money for it.
We're working our way through the latest developments on Capitol Hill, closer to home here in Wisconsin, with Charles Franklin. He's director of the Marquette University Law School Poll and a professor of law and public policy there. You can join in, 800-642-1234. What's on your mind about the Foxconn deal? What do you think of the proposal to ease environmental regulations for Foxconn? What would you do? 800-642-1234. Back after this news. Governor Scott Walker has ordered state lawmakers into special session beginning today to consider an incentive package that would award Taiwanese electronics manufacturer Foxconn $3 billion over 15 years. The incentive package would also waive some state environmental reviews. Good morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for the Joy Cardine Show. Charles Franklin stays with us. He's director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's a professor of law and public policy. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Is the state putting out too much for Foxconn? Do you see a major return on investment here? 800-642-1234. You can post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. But before we get to Foxconn, Jim in Rice Lake has a question for you, Charles. And Jim, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead, Jim.
Election system that started in 2010 and has been ruled illegal by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, if it will have any political ramifications on.
And Jim is breaking up there. I think you know the gist here, Charles.
Yeah, there is a case challenging the districting in the state. That case was accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court, which will hear the arguments this fall. So we do not know when the court will rule and whether they will require a change in the districts or not. One of the challenges will be that the later they rule, the less time there is to draw the new districts and for candidates and voters to figure out what districts they're in and how that would go. We don't yet know the ramifications of such a decision. And indeed, we don't know whether the Supreme Court would uphold the lower court decision striking down our previous districts or whether the court will side with the legislature and retain those districts. So that'll be developments that we see over the fall and possibly as late as the spring.
We'll certainly be keeping an eye on that. Now, turning to Foxconn, the special legislative session beginning at 11 o'clock this morning, Governor Walker unveiled a proposal last week that would ease environmental regulations in order for construction of Foxconn's facility in southeastern Wisconsin to build faster. It would also borrow more money to finish up the I-94 project between Milwaukee and Illinois. Charles, do you expect this to pass with bipartisan support?
Well, it's certainly on a fast track. The Republican Party and the governor, who are having a lot of trouble agreeing on our current state budget, seem at this point, at least, to be pretty united on this proposal. So in that sense, they can pass this with or without Democratic support. Democrats face the issue of how to criticize the opportunity for these jobs. And you've heard criticisms on the one hand that the $3 billion over, I believe it's 15 years, is not worth the returns that would be expected. And also for people with strong environmental preferences, that waiving environmental regulations for the construction of this gigantic factory, said to be as the size of 11 football fields, is something that the state also shouldn't do. But I think it does pit the tax incentives and other breaks for big corporations and how to weigh that against the creation of 3,000 jobs initially, claims of as many as 13,000 jobs in the long run. One of the elements there and one of the things the governor has stressed is that those payments are dependent on the company actually creating what it is currently saying it will create.
Meeting the benchmarks.
And if they don't meet those benchmarks, we won't give them the benefits. That's certainly an appealing claim, but our problems with the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation over the last 7 years has shown that that much smaller agency has had trouble maintaining the conditions and seeing the achievements of promised job creation as well. So I think there is some reason for skepticism about how this is handled, but it's also a very enticing opportunity to see the number of jobs, but also the entry of a major modern technology manufacturing coming into the state, where we remain one of the top two manufacturing states in the nation, but much of that manufacturing is still in heavy equipment, machinery, and other kinds of, if you will, old technology.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Darren in Eau Claire. Hi, Darren.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the working conditions that the Chinese workers have at Foxconn. I hear that they're not very good. I just wanted to know what your thoughts on that were.
Yeah, I'm certainly not an expert on this, so let me begin with that disclaimer. Foxconn has these unbelievably massive factories in China with workforces that largely live there. It's like our old company towns. And workers are worked very, very hard there. You know, I think a company here has to adapt to U.S. working conditions and the tolerance of workers for what they'll put up with. But this, as I understand it, is largely assembly jobs where you're putting components together. I think one of the real concerns would be that sort of assembly job may be replaceable by robotics in the near future. And so I think that is the technological threat to the number of these jobs, and the working conditions really does depend on whether American workers are satisfied and willing to take the jobs in that situation.
And Governor Walker toured the state Friday to convey that areas outside of southeastern Wisconsin will benefit from Foxconn. He also had a message for the naysayers who say Wisconsin is paying too steep of a price to have the company here.
There's a whole lot of people out there scrambling to try and come up with some reason not to like this. I can tell you that's fine, but I think, you know, they can go suck lemons. The rest of us are going to cheer and figure out how we get this thing going forward.
So as a political scientist, Charles, how big a win is this for the governor?
Well, I think rhetorically it's a very big win because job creation is easy to sell. Restraining investment in new jobs, whether it's because of environmental concerns or because of too generous a set of subsidies, that's a harder sell in the face of jobs. I think one thing that is easy that's not talked about much is a lot of these employees are going to be driving up from northern Illinois. Mm-hmm. And so in a sense, Wisconsin is paying for a substantial number of jobs that will be held by Illinois voters and taxpayers, and Illinois is playing no role in contributing to this, at least none that I've heard of.
This is going to be in Paul Ryan's district. How much did politics play in this?
Certainly on the face of it, you're a Chinese manufacturer, a Taiwanese manufacturer looking, you're locating in the Speaker of the House district in a state that the president barely won, that was critical to his victory, and with a governor seeking re-election and possibly another run at the White House, it does seem like smart political moves by Foxconn to come here. But I think it's also fair to point out the benefits that a new major manufacturing facility has, not only for Foxconn, but for all the suppliers that create and supply components to them. We could see substantial developments from other major companies that want to be here because they want to manufacture things that then get delivered to the Foxconn factory for assembly, and that those opportunities create multiplier effects, if you will, more jobs created in the related industries. To put it the opposite direction, think about when GM closed the plant in Janesville. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just the GM workers that lost their jobs. It was all the other suppliers and ancillary workers, food service workers, and so on, that were also severely hurt by that. So we could have some of those ancillary gains from Foxconn.
Take another call now. Tony in Tomahawk. Go ahead, Tony.
Yes, good morning. Problem could be that we're setting bad precedents for all the companies that want to come here or even existing companies. They'll want those same tax breaks. They'll want environmental regulations removed. And we've had a lot of broken promises in Wisconsin. We were supposed to have 250,000 jobs. That was Walker's first-term goal. He missed it by 100,000 jobs. We've heard a lot of promises, but... why on the fast track? Does it have to be approved by Tuesday, by today, for God's sakes.
Well,
Slow down and think it over. The session begins today.
Yeah, Charles, go ahead.
Yeah, I think this is a valid critique, is how do you know that these concessions are good in the short run, but how do you know that they're good in the long run when every subsequent manufacturer would negotiate these same kinds of concessions? This is the dilemma of states competing with each other by offering enticements for these locations. And I think the political positive of jobs that then is a very strong incentive for elected officials to want to do whatever they do to take credit for that, even if there are costs and possibly uneconomical decisions offering more incentives than you get in benefits. But that latter part, is it worth it or not? What are the ancillary benefits? What are the spinoff companies and so on? Those are highly debatable and very hard to know what the true answer is. And so that is why legislative hearings, testimony, and so on become part of this debate. But how in the longer term does the state not go into a slippery slope of having to offer uneconomic incentives to any company trying to move in? I think that is a legitimate debate and worthy of both parties engaging in what their development strategy is and whether those strategies do seem worthwhile in the long run. And I think we'd benefit from hearing both parties lay out their arguments.
So as we begin to wrap up, Charles, how big of an issue do you see Foxconn being in the governor's race?
I see it as something, and I think the audio that you played from him shows how enthusiastic he is, how much he believes that he can point to this as a big victory for his administration. I think the political question would be, how do Democrats and eventually Democratic candidates for governor respond to this? What's the nature of their criticism, if there's criticism, and there has been in the last few days, versus how much they choose to say, this is a good thing and we're glad we're getting it, but we disagree with the governor on the following more important issues. That's a purely political decision that, happily, I'm not in campaigns. I'll leave to the campaigners to decide how to handle.
So we'll be watching the special session with you.
Yes.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's a professor of law and public policy. He's the co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. This hour was produced by Bill Martins and Nyjah Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for the Joy Cardine Show. And you're with us here on the Ideas Network.